Joining us today on the summit is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Mr. Kennedy, welcome and thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Your work and your background, Mr. Kennedy, you really need no introduction. Obviously, our audience is going to be familiar with you. You're a member of America's leading family, and you're not afraid of rejection. You're not afraid to rock the boat, especially for children's health and their rights, and you're willing to speak truth to power. Before we dive into your perspective on 5G, I wanted to first ask you, was there a turning point in your life, or was it a gradual process, or perhaps it was genetic? What led you to this role that you currently have of being a freedom fighter and willing just to take a bold stand for what you feel is right?
Well, I got involved in the environmental issues when I was a very little kid. I love the outdoors, I love the rivers and streams and animals, and I was very involved with wildlife, and from when I was little, and I was conscious of pollution. This was back in the late 50s and early 60s, and there was, Washington, D.C. had cement plants that were belching up smoke, and the soot would come down and land on your clothes, and at that time there was a lot of air pollution. There were tens of thousands of people who died every year in our country. I was conscious of that we were losing species. In 1963, I was deeply involved in hawks and falcons, training hawks from when I was a little kid, and the kind of iconic bird for me was the Eastern Adams peregrine falcon, which was the eastern version of the most spectacular predatory bird in the world. It was a salmon pink and a beautiful white coverlet on its ear, and there was a pair of them that used to nest on the old post office building in Washington, D.C. And whenever I'd go visit my father, who was the attorney general, or my uncle in the White House, I would look forward to those trips because I could look down Pennsylvania Avenue to the post office building, and I could see these birds up there, and they're the fastest birds in the world. They flew 240 miles an hour, and I could watch them come down Pennsylvania Avenue at these extraordinary speeds and pick pigeons out of the air right in front of the White House, 50 or 60 feet above the White House. And for me, seeing a sight like that was more exciting than visiting my uncle the White House. But that bird went extinct from DDT in 1963, the same year that my uncle was killed. I couldn't swim the Charles or Potomac or Hudson when I was growing up because of the pollution. I remember the Cuyahoga River burning in 69. I remember the Santa Barbara oil spill, and I remember when Lake Erie, which was the biggest fishery, half the fish in the Great Lakes, came out of Lake Erie, and when it was declared dead. And that drove 20 million Americans out of the street in 1970. I was 16 years old and went to New York City to demonstrate. Oh, I was involved with the environment from when I was little. When I was 8 years old, I wrote my uncle, the president, a letter and asked him if I could come and talk to him about pollution in the White House. And I went, he invited me there, and I spent time with him in the Oval Office. And then he arranged for me to meet with Rachel Carson, who came to our house in Hickory Hill, and who he was actually defending at that time from the attacks by Monsanto and by his own USDA, by the Department of Agriculture, and also with his Secretary of the Interior. Well, I was always involved in that. When I became an attorney, I went to work for fishermen on the Hudson, suing polluters, and helped build the Waterkeeper Alliance, which is now 350. Waterkeepers in 44 countries, with the biggest water protection group in the world. I got dragged kicking and screaming into the vaccine issue. I was litigating at that time on behalf of various waterkeepers in the United States and Canada against about, I think, 38 coal-burning power plants and cement kilns across North America, mainly for discharging mercury. That's what we were targeted on. The FDA had just done a survey that found that 100% of freshwater fish in the United States were contaminated with dangerous levels of mercury, and you know, most of that was coming from coal-burning power plants. Well, I was going around the country talking about those lawsuits, and wherever I went, these women would sit in the front row, and they'd come up to me afterward, and they were very presentable. They were professionals, most of them. They were pharmacists and doctors and lawyers, and one of them was a psychiatrist named Sarah Bridges, and they kept handing me scientific studies and saying, if you're really sincere about your concern about mercury exposures to children, you should look at mercury in vaccines. And I avoided doing it for a long time. One of them actually came to my house in Cape Cod, and she was the mother of a child who had gotten autism from a vaccine and actually got an award from the vaccine court that recognized that his autism came from the vaccine. Oh. And she said, I'm not going to leave here until you read these studies. And she handed me a whole pile of scientific studies. And I'm accustomed to reading science. I wanted to be a scientist when I was a kid. That's one of the reasons I got into this racket. And I, you know, virtually all of my lawsuits, I've had hundreds of lawsuits, and virtually all of them included some kind of scientific controversy. So I'm comfortable reading science, and when I sat down and read it, I was immediately struck by the delta between what the scientific establishment, the medical establishment, were saying about vaccines and mercury and what the science actually said. And that kind of took me down a wormhole on this issue, and you know, that it has ended up really kind of changing my career in many ways and taking me away from what I'd really like to be doing, which is to be suing water polluters and you know, working on energy issues and environmental issues, to spending a lot more time working on children's health. Hmm.
So you founded the Children's Health Defense Organization because of your, like you were talking about how you became aware of vaccines and then the harmful side of them that really has been covered up. How does 5G fit into your initiative?
Children's Health addresses, you know, or advocates on behalf of children's health and particularly against toxic exposures, including pesticides like glyphosate. We've been very instrumental and involved in the Roundup cases, litigation, PFOAs, and then, you know, other kind of pesticides, fluoridation. And so 5G is, you know, something that it really fits in with all of the other things we're doing, because it's another, you know, our children today are walking around or swimming around in a toxic soup. And there's a lot of inflammation and reaction that has synergistic effects that's coming from all kinds of different stresses. And 5G may be an aggravating factor in all of those things. You know, electromagnetic waves, we know, impact children, and they impact fetuses and children more than they do adults. We know they cause immune activation, they cause inflammation, that the World Health Organization has said they are probable carcinogens. Mm-hmm. And this is, we're talking about existing cell phones, for example, which are, I think, 2.4 megahertz or gigahertz. Mm-hmm. You know, much less potent in terms of their capacity to disrupt genes and to and disrupt the electric currents in our body. So we're deeply concerned, particularly because you have a captured agency here, FCC, which is a kind of a poster child for a captured agency of a very powerful industry, multi-trillion-dollar telecommunications industry. You have a military involvement, which is, which makes it a lot more difficult because there are immunity issues. It's hard to sue them. It's hard to bring them under the discipline of democracy. There's immunity from litigation for human health effects in certain contexts with this already. So, and big data today is driving everything. And this is and there's so many powerful interests within society that want to see this happen. The big tech people in Silicon Valley, like Elon Musk and Amazon, that are putting all these satellites up, the big telecommunications companies, the Pentagon, the CIA, and then all of the other stakeholders in, building up our data. And there's imperatives, including competing with the Chinese and the Russians and other people around the world. And, this is a system that can be weaponized. Military applications, and so it's being pushed through without much thought. I mean, a few months ago, the highest executives of the telecommunications companies went before the Senate, and they were asked, "Have you ever done any health studies on 5G?" And they said, "No." And they were asked, "Have you allocated money to do health studies?" And they said, "No." And that seems kind of crazy because we know that there are literally thousands and thousands of peer-reviewed publications that associate not only 5G, but 4G with detrimental effects on fetal and newborn development, on detrimental effects on young children, on brain tumors, other cancers, DNA damage, altered gene expression, neurological effects, cognitive impairment, impaired sperm function and quality, altered metabolism, cardiovascular diseases, learning and memory deficits, and many, many other, and not only human beings, but also that 5G actually has the capacity to alter the entire ecosystem. Nobody has studied it. Nobody knows what it's going to do. And yet, somehow, it has its own logic that it is pushing it through the political process without any kind of impediment or questioning. It's really insane. It's a huge nightmare global experiment with human beings. The ecosystem has been fixed.
Yeah, and we saw that the Belgian Minister of the Environment and Housing for Brussels said that exact thing. I don't want my people to be as guinea pigs. You can't put 5G in, right? So, but let's talk about the environment a little bit more, the environmental effects of 5G. In other words, the pollinators, the animals, the soil. I know that there's some studies there. What can you tell us from your perspective as an environmental legal expert on this side of the 5G question?
I'm an honest scientist, so I don't really know, but I know there's a guy called Alan Shope, who's a famous architect, and he's an environmental leader. He also has an apiary at his home in Millbrook, New York. He has a lot of hives there. And about 10 years ago, I was at his house, and he said, I want to show you something. And he took my cell phone, and he put his cell phone on top of a beehive, and he called his cell phone, which was on vibrate. And when his phone rang, all the bees came out of the hive, and even the queen came out. And I was like, holy cow, I've never seen anything like that. I've been around bees my whole life. And
I've never seen anything like that before. It takes a lot to get the queen to come out of alive. And I said to him, why is it doing that? And he said, I don't know. So and I don't know why, and I don't know if anybody knows, but it's disturbing. And the fact that, you know, that something that has even that kind of observed animal effect that I've seen, the fact that we can, you know, that we're gonna allow 20,000 satellites to beam that down on all this. And, you know, I was at Standing Rock during the, you know, the demonstrations against the pipeline, and they were, I didn't get hit with that. Although they had a, you know, they had a electronic wave weapon there. Mm. And they had sound weapons, which I was attacked with.
Wow.
And they had water, but people, other people there had been there when they had turned on the electromagnetic weapons, whatever they are, and they described it, and they said it felt like their skin was burning up, and they just wanted to run away. Hmm. And, you know, the fill, the, I honestly, the other thing is, these are going to be low-level satellites. They're in the ionosphere. We have no, that's a very, very fragile part of the, you know, the physiological ecosystem of the planet. And we have no idea what it will do if we, you know, to, if we disrupt the ionosphere that way. There's so many unanswered questions.
Yeah.
And the experiment is so vast and so huge, it's literally, there's no part of the planet where anybody will be able to go to escape this. I mean, one of the good things is that there are people, there are localities around the planet, as you pointed out, that are saying, we're not going to allow the antennas here. Mm-hmm. Let's wait and see what happens. Let's see some science on them first. Some people are standing up, and they are, you know, they, in a number of communities that have stood up against them, they've won those battles. It's a very, very powerful industry, and these are tiny pockets at this time, and they're going to be able to end run everybody if they put it in space.
No.
Any choice.
Okay, so you helped to lead the charge against Monsanto for that first big lawsuit. So what, from your perspective, Bobby, on what you're seeing Monsanto and how they're very likely, you know, falling. First of all, do you think Monsanto's going down? And second of all, if you could relate it to what you see happening within big telecom, is that also on a long sort of timeline for them to go down? What, I mean, how do you see this big picture happening, first with Monsanto and then with the big telecom and 5G?
I've been involved in all three Monsanto.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose you can say it's analogous because it's a very powerful industry that has a captive agency. And that was able for, you know, for 40 years to collaborate